Chapter 10. Ah, you can hardly do justice to the subject in such a short time, said Selden, as the Dreamer girls caught sight of Miss Bart, and while she signaled a response to their boisterous greeting, he added quickly, won't you devote your afternoon to it? You know I must be off tomorrow morning. We'll take a walk, and you can thank me at your leisure. The afternoon was perfect. A deeper stillness possessed the air, and the glitter of the American autumn was tempered by a haze which diffused the brightness without dulling it. In the woody hollows of the park there was already a faint chill, but as the ground rose the air grew lighter, and ascending the long slopes beyond the high road, Lily and her companion reached a zone of lingering summer. The path wound across a meadow with scattered trees, then it dipped into a lane plumed with asters and purpling sprays of bramble, whence, through the light quiver of ash leaves, the country unrolled itself in pastoral distances. Higher up, the lane showed thickening tufts of fern, and of the creeping glossy verdure of shaded slopes. Trees began to overhang it, and the shade deepened to the checkered dusk of a beech grove. The boles of the trees stood well apart, with only a light feathering of undergrowth. The path wound along the edge of the wood, now and then looking out on a sunlit pasture, or on an orchard spangled with fruit. Lily had no real intimacy with nature, but as he had a passion for the appropriate, and could be keenly sensitive to a scene which was the fitting background of her own sensations. The landscape outspread below her seemed an enlargement of her present mood, and she found something of herself in its calmness, its breadth, its long free reaches. On the nearer slopes the sugar maples wavered like pyres of light. Lower down was a massing of gray orchards, and here and there the lingering green of an oak grove. Two or three red farmhouses dozed under the apple trees, and the white wooden spire of a village church showed beyond the shoulder of the hill, while far below, in a haze of dust, the high road ran between the fields. Let us sit here, Selden suggested, as they reached an open ledge of rock above which the beeches rose steeply between mossy boulders. Lily dropped down on the rock, glowing with her long climb. She sat quiet, her lips parted by the stress of the ascent, her eyes wandering peacefully over the broken ranges of the landscape. Selden stretched himself on the grass at her feet, tilting his hat against the level sun rays, and clasping his hands behind his head, which rested against the side of the rock. He had no wish to make her talk. Her quick breathing silence seemed a part of the general hush and harmony of things. In his own mind there was only a lazy sense of pleasure, veiling the sharp edges of sensation as the September haze veiled the scene at their feet. But Lily, though her attitude was as calm as his, was throbbing inwardly with a rush of thoughts. There were in her at the moment two beings, one drawing deep breaths of freedom and exhilaration, the other gasping for air in a little black prison house of fears. But gradually the captive's gasps grew fainter, or the other paid less heed to them. The horizon expanded, the air grew stronger, and the free spirit quivered for flight. She could not herself have explained the sense of buoyancy which seemed to lift and swing her above the sun-suffused world at her feet. Was it love, she wondered, or a mere fortuitous combination of happy thoughts and sensations? How much of it was owing to the spell of the perfect afternoon, the scent of the fading woods, the thought of the dullness as he had fled from? Lily had no definite experience by which to test the quality of her feelings. As he had several times been in love with fortunes or careers, but only once with a man. That was years ago, when she first came out, and had been smitten with a romantic passion for a young gentleman named Herbert Melson, who had blue eyes and a little wave in his hair. Mr. Melson, who was possessed of no other negotiable securities, had hastened to employ these in capturing the eldest Miss Van Osburgh. Since then he had grown stout and wheezy, and was given to telling anecdotes about his children. If Lily recalled this early emotion, it was not to compare it with that which now possessed her. The only point of comparison was the sense of lightness, of emancipation, which he remembered feeling in the whirl of a waltz, or the seclusion of a conservatory, during the brief course of her youthful romance. As he had not known again till today that lightness, that glow of freedom, but now it was something more than a blind groping of the blood. The peculiar charm of her feeling for Selden was that she understood it. She could put her finger on every link of the chain that was drawing them together. Though his popularity was of the quiet kind, felt rather than actively expressed among his friends, as he had never mistaken his inconspicuousness for obscurity. His reputed cultivation was generally regarded as a slight obstacle to easy intercourse, but Lily, who prided herself on her broad-minded recognition of literature, and always carried an omercium in her traveling bag, was attracted by this attribute, which she felt would have had its distinction in an older society. It was, moreover, one of his gifts to look his part, to have a height which lifted his head above the crowd, and the keenly modeled dark features which, in a land of amorphous types, gave him the air of belonging to a more specialized race, of carrying the impress of a concentrated past. Expansive persons found him a little dry, and very young girls thought him sarcastic. But this air of friendly aloofness, as far removed as possible from any assertion of personal advantage, was the quality which piqued Lily's interest. Everything about him accorded with the fastidious element in her taste, even to the light irony with which he surveyed what seemed to her most sacred. She admired him most of all, perhaps, for being able to convey as distinct a sense of superiority as the richest man as he had ever met. It was the unconscious prolongation of this thought which led her to say presently, with a laugh, "I have broken two engagements for you today. How many have you broken for me?" "None," said Selden calmly. "My only engagement at Bellomont was with you." She glanced down at him, faintly smiling. "Did you really come to Bellomont to see me?" "Of course I did." Her look deepened meditatively. "Why?" she murmured, with an accent which took all tinge of coquetry from the question. "Because you're such a wonderful spectacle. I always like to see what you are doing. How do you know what I should be doing if you were not here?" Selden smiled. I don't flatter myself that my coming has deflected your course of action by a hair's breadth. That's absurd since, if you were not here, I could obviously not be taking a walk with you." "No, but your taking a walk with me is only another way of making use of your material. You are an artist, and I happen to be the bit of color you are using today. It's a part of your cleverness to be able to produce premeditated effects extemporaneously." Lily smiled also. His words were too acute not to strike her sense of humor. It was true that she meant to use the accident of his presence as part of a very definite effect, or that, at least, was the secret pretext as he had found for breaking her promise to walk with Mr. Grice. As he had sometimes been accused of being too eager, even Judy Treanor had warned her to go slowly. Well, she would not be too eager in this case. She would give her suitor a longer taste of suspense. Where duty and inclination jumped together, it was not in Lily's nature to hold them asunder. As he had excused herself from the walk on the plea of a headache. The horrid headache which, in the morning, had prevented her venturing to church. Her appearance at luncheon justified the excuse. She looked languid, full of a suffering sweetness. She carried a scent bottle in her hand. Mr. Grice was new to such manifestations. He wondered rather nervously if she were delicate, having far-reaching fears about the future of his progeny. But sympathy won the day, and he besought her not to expose herself. He always connected the outer air with ideas of exposure. Lily had received his sympathy with languid gratitude, urging him, since she should be such poor company, to join the rest of the party who, after luncheon, were starting in automobiles on a visit to the Van Osburghs at Peekskill. Mr. Grice was touched by her disinterestedness, and, to escape from the threatened vacuity of the afternoon, had taken her advice and departed mournfully, in a dust hood and goggles. As the motor car plunged down the avenue, she smiled at his resemblance to a baffled beetle. Selden had watched her maneuvers with lazy amusement. As he had made no reply to his suggestion that they should spend the afternoon together, but as her plan unfolded itself, he felt fairly confident of being included in it. The house was empty when at length he heard her step on the stair and strolled out of the billiard room to join her. As he had on a hat and walking dress, and the dogs were bounding at her feet. "I thought, after all, the air might do me good," she explained. And he agreed that so simple a remedy was worth trying. The excursionists would be gone at least 4 hours. Lily and Selden had the whole afternoon before them, and the sense of leisure and safety gave the last touch of lightness to her spirit. With so much time to talk, and no definite object to be led up to, she could taste the rare joys of mental vagrancy. She felt so free from ulterior motives that she took up his charge with a touch of resentment. "I don't know," she said, "why you are always accusing me of premeditation. I thought you confessed to it. You told me the other day that you had to follow a certain line, and if one does a thing at all, it is a merit to do it thoroughly. If you mean that a girl who has no one to think for her is obliged to think for herself, I am quite willing to accept the imputation. But you must find me a dismal kind of person if you suppose that I never yield to an impulse." "Ah, but I don't suppose that. Haven't I told you that your genius lies in converting impulses into intentions?" "My genius?" she echoed with a sudden note of weariness. "Is there any final test of genius but success? And I certainly haven't succeeded." Selden pushed his hat back and took a side glance at her. "Success, what is success? I shall be interested to have your definition." "Success?" she hesitated. "Why, to get as much as one can out of life, I suppose. It's a relative quality, after all. Isn't that your idea of it?" "My idea of it? God forbid." He sat up with sudden energy, resting his elbows on his knees, and staring out upon the mellow fields. "My idea of success," he said, "is personal freedom." "Freedom? Freedom from worries? From everything, from money, from poverty, from ease and anxiety, from all the material accidents. To keep a kind of republic of the spirit, that's what I call success." She leaned forward with a responsive flash. I know it's strange, but that's just what I've been feeling today." He met her eyes with the latent sweetness of his. "Is the feeling so rare with you?" he said. She blushed a little under his gaze. "Why, you think me horribly sordid, don't you? But perhaps it's rather that I never had any choice. There was no one, to tell me about the Republic of the Spirit. There never is, it's a country one has to find the way to oneself. But I should never have found my way there if you hadn't told me." "Ah, there are signposts, but one has to know how to read them." "Well, I have known, she cried with a glow of eagerness. "W, whenever I see you, I find myself spelling out a letter of the sign, and yesterday last evening at dinner I suddenly saw a little way into your republic." Selden was still looking at her, but with a changed eye. Hitherto he had found, in her presence and her talk, the aesthetic amusement which a reflective man is apt to seek in desultory intercourse with pretty women. His attitude had been one of admiring spectatorship, and he would have been almost sorry to detect in her any emotional weakness which should interfere with the fulfillment of her aims. But now the hint of this weakness had become the most interesting thing about her. He had come on her that morning in a moment of disarray. Her face had been pale and altered, and the diminution of her beauty had lent her a poignant charm. "That is how she looks when she is alone," had been his first thought, and the second was to note in her the change which his coming produced. It was the danger point of their intercourse that he could not doubt the spontaneity of her liking. From whatever angle he viewed their dawning intimacy, he could not see it as part of her scheme of life. and to be the unforeseen element in a career so accurately planned was stimulating even to a man who had renounced sentimental experiments. Well, he said, did it make you want to see more? Are you going to become one of us? He had drawn out his cigarettes as he spoke, and she reached her hand toward the case. Oh, do give me one, I haven't smoked for days. Why such unnatural abstinence? Everybody smokes at Bellomont. Yes, but it is not considered becoming in a June Fillamarier, and at the present moment I am a June Fillamarier. Ah, then I'm afraid we can't let you into the Republic. Why not? Is it a celibate order? Not in the least, though I'm bound to say there are not many married people in it. But you will marry someone very rich, and it's as hard for rich people to get into as the Kingdom of Heaven. That's unjust, I think, because, as I understand it, one of the conditions of citizenship is not to think too much about money, and the only way not to think about money is to have a great deal of it. You might as well say that the only way not to think about air. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.